and so on, whereby one is not tied to a monopoly that goes, you know, every half hour only on certain routes. I think that that is a process that one could do in a city. Other cities one sees, I mean, I think of European cities, they have mixes of transportation. I mean, one does have to get from A to B, and the question is, how do you do it? And there is the time factor. People are worried about time factor. People are worried about taking children to certain locations within the city. So there has to be various options for doing that, and all options should be explored. But those options that can minimize the impact of the automobile on our society should be explored in greater depth.
Thank you very much. Sir?
With respect to strategies, I noticed in one of the more recent editions of L.L. Bean that they're supporting a mission statement in America which focuses on, by 1999, that every American will be within 20 minutes walking distance of their place of work. I feel that this is not necessarily just a question of transportation, but a question of sense of place, and a sense of place which is not only attractive to walk, but to cycle, but also to use motorized vehicles. And I think since we're all visually oriented, the more attractive those options are, the more we will use them. The third item which I'd like to pick up on is supporting the reference of this city and other cities of using text such as a pattern language, and there's an additional text called a design with nature, which very, very thoroughly lay out the options of working and planning with cities. And I think the most discouraging is these books are about 10 and 15 years old, and how many people read them in school but use them in reality? I mean, these things are not fresh off the press. I'll calm down. This is a question of land use and design. And this country is turning out designers who are hungry to meet the challenges. And why they're not being given these challenges of working with these problems and in a more holistic viewpoint or perspective, I don't know. But if anything, I hope this process does open this up so we don't just look at this from a one-dimensional or myopic thinking. And I think in this city, given the question which was brought up before about setbacks, we have a classic example of planning in this city which we could hold up to the country, and that's Wellington and Gordon. Great setbacks.
Great, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. As you know by now, I'm probably a rail advocate, talking about railways all the time, but anyways, recently attending the transportation open house that the city of Guelph had, I walked in, I looked at their wall charts and their maps of the new roads that they were planning to put in, and it looked like an ugly medical chart of varicose veins. Now, the city of Guelph, being that it has a profitable railway company, it has for the last 108 years, I think it can turn that around for itself and also get some of this ugly traffic off the roads, especially the big trucks that terrorize the bicycles down Gordon and whatever. If it's that simple to plot a new highway from the 401 into Guelph, I cannot see why that Guelph could not easily put a right-of-way for the rails to go where the land use is for the industrial sections. I brought that up with them, and they just say, well, railway use is going down, and it just reflects the fact that they're not up with the current trends, and they're reluctant to take on the current trends or find out about it. So that's exactly what I'd like to see is at least done from that perspective of a type of transport, is that I think the right-of-way should be implemented, at least to the South Hanlon where the new industrial yards are, and Guelph can continue to have that advantage.
Great, thank you very much.
I think the rail is a wonderful idea, incidentally. I'm not a, you know, rail advocate per se, although really I think it's a wonderful idea, not just for the industry, but also for public transit. In terms of strategies, I'd just like to read very briefly a little information from overseas. I always tout the European example, and here's a little more on the European example. When traffic engineers met recently in Dietersheim to talk about driving in cities, they were reflecting a new philosophy. Rather than try to speed up traffic or keep it running smoothly, their aim was to interrupt and decelerate the traffic flow, to keep it constantly, if slowly, on the move by means of optical and acoustic speed breakers. This alternative approach, which turns traditional concepts on their head, received no questioning from the engineers and planners in attendance. For instance, wide roads, not narrow ones, are the most accident-prone. And the less clear the road conditions, the slower the drivers go. Roads must be as narrow as possible, with as many pedestrian crossings as possible, and vision impaired by an abundance of roadside trees. In other words, much more space for pedestrians, much less space for automobiles. I'm not saying get rid of the automobiles either, I'm just saying give them less space, not more. The second, there are several other strategies that they have, and one more that I should mention is several transit authorities have introduced environmental transit passes. These are passes good for a full year and for all public transit modes. Although they have actually increased deficits, there's the D word, local officials are continuing to support them because they have increased ridership so much and reduced car traffic. They have also resulted in increased frequencies for most routes, which in itself is expected to further increase ridership. Eventually, it will break even. Surveys are showing that many new riders have sold their car and many companies are purchasing the passes for employees. This, of course, depends upon a good basic public transit system being in place, which we don't have yet in the city of Guelph. Lastly, I would like to say that we should forget the left-turn lanes on Gordon Street. We don't need to widen Gordon Street for bike lanes if we forget about the left-turn lanes for cars. Why make things easier for cars? Let's make things easier for bicycles and pedestrians.
Thank you very much.
I think the key is integration. I think we have to emphasize through good design the use of bikes and walking as a pleasant experience, a pleasant mode of transportation. We have to try to make the experience for bicyclers and walkers more appealing by the creation of beautiful spaces, for example, more seating areas and walking paths.
Terrific. Thank you.
First of all, I think there needs to be a lot more political activism on this issue. This point of view needs to be brought to the attention of politicians. I think politicians love to be politically correct and they love to be environmentally correct. And I don't think that this would be a terribly hard sell, provided that there wasn't a lot of resistance from other quarters. However, we've heard some points that were raised by people who fear that moving away from automobiles means taking away people's cars. The point has been made that some people around this table would find it relatively easy to give up their car, or may have done so already, but there are many, many people living in Canadian cities who are stuck in urban structures which basically put them in their cars and really don't give them many other choices, and we have to start thinking about reassuring those people about what these kinds of changes could mean. One of the things I think we need is the articulation in a very tangible way of what it might mean to live in a community which was less car-oriented. People have raised points about the way things are done in Europe, for example, but a lot of us don't have experience with what those cities are like and what day-to-day life is like. We need photographs and films and models and videos and drawings to say, this is the sort of community that we can create. These are the benefits that we can give you in exchange for using your car less, not to take it away from you, but maybe to get less traffic on the road.
Excellent point. Thank you. At the back, can we have anyone stand up and speak who'd like to do that?
Robert Faulkner from the Transportation Commission. I wish I could read all my notes here, but I'll hit on a few highlights. I just moved here from Fredericton to Brunswick, and I don't think Fredericton is particularly more progressive than Guelph or most other cities, but a lot of comparisons. But what we did have down there that seemed to work, and we might have it in Guelph, I just don't know about it yet. I've been here just about a month, is what we called a Transportation Planning and Management Committee. It's basically staff, myself, Transit Department, City Engineers Department, Planning Department, Recreation, City Solicitor, a few other departments, key people from each department to ensure that any issue to do with transportation was discussed on an interdepartmental and somewhat coordinated basis. Might be worthy of consideration here if we don't already have it.
Were citizens sitting on that particular panel, or was that just
staff? It was a staff committee meeting, but we certainly received representation from citizens, and in fact, as I recall, probably half of the issues we discussed were prompted by citizen concerns.
I hate to be impertinent, but I want to know if any of the staff members rode bicycles.
Yes, and I'm amongst them. Not a daily rider, user, mind you, but yeah, many did.
Thanks.
And pedestrian, but you know, Fredericton is geographically larger than the city, but half the population. And that brings us to an issue that I have to reiterate, and that's population density. You cannot compare Japan and typical European cities to the North American example. We just don't have the density. We don't have the mindset. We don't have the tradition. We do have higher disposable incomes. Because of the higher disposable incomes generally, we want to be more free. We want our freedoms. Just can't make those direct comparisons without looking at the whole scene. Certainly it's worthy of consideration, but it's not an apples and apples comparison on transit or any transportation issue, or any social economic issue for that matter. Flex time. Somebody talked about traffic congestion during the rush hour. Simple solution, get the employers locally to involve flex time. Many of you would probably be familiar with that, are you familiar with that term, but that solves a lot of problems. Ottawa's an example of a very pro-transit city, and pro-pedestrian and pro-bicycle city. And they have encouraged flex time amongst most of the federal departments in the downtown area and many other private employers. And it's been successful. I think I heard, I'm not sure from whom, but some student representative is here. What works in some cities, Kingston and Peterborough come to mind quickly, the student ID cards are accepted on the local transit systems as passes. It's for a fee, of course, but that's an issue I think, if it hasn't been considered here seriously, it should be considered.
Did you get that down, Margaret? Could you repeat that, Mr. Funk, if you don't mind?
Oh, sure. Well, the local transit commission, in this case, the Guelph Transportation Commission, would negotiate with, I guess, the student council or whatever agency representing students and come up with some predetermined annual fee, which the student would, the student agency would then pay to the transit commission, and for that fee, students would be able to board the buses all day long, all night long. I'm sorry, during the whole service hour. During the entire time the service is provided, just by flashing the ID card.
Prior to 8 p.m., is that
well, whatever the hours are. Right, but, right, right. You know, those kind of things are fully up to negotiation, but typically, you know, when the buses are in operation, the students would board and just flash their student ID card, not worry about carrying cash, not worry about getting a transfer, just because the transit commission would receive a one-time fee in September. The students would pay it probably through their initiation fee or some
good
basis.
Idea.
And I say locally in this area, Kingston, Queen's University in Kingston and Trent at Peterborough and a lot of others have similar kind of programs. To defense to our engineers that are present, those of us who consider ourselves in that field a bit, the Transportation Association of Canada and ITE, the Institution of Traffic or Transportation Engineers? The Institute of Transportation Engineers and the Institute of Planning, you know, Planning Institute of Canada and all those kind of things, those groups set the standards by which these people do their jobs. And when city councils or municipal councils or government agencies hire engineers, they require them to follow the integrity of the standards set by those associations.
So if those standards are not acceptable to a growing number of people, what can be done about it? Because we're talking about strategies.
Each of those agencies have groups that revise or that consider revision of their standards, standing committees that review the stuff, and there's a system that allows those kind of things to be amended.
So if a particular city like this one cares to deviate from those standards, are you saying that's an impediment? And my question again would be, what strategy can we implement to overcome that impediment?
I'm going to enter a bit of territory. Maybe I shouldn't, but I'll do it anyway. Those engineers who practice outside the acceptable standards of the industry,
right,
could find themselves at risk, obviously, for doing, well,
so
basically that, unacceptable
so that's,
practice.
That's a serious obstacle, clearly.
I would suggest it is in some issues, yeah. Like width of roadways, the warrants for intersection change, intersection size and traffic light considerations, all those kind of things.
What about some of the issues that are closer to what your job will be now that you're only a month here, but I say will be in the future? For instance, smaller vehicles. That was brought up here tonight,
Well, if we're talking the jitney kind of operations that are typical in the Caribbean and perhaps in the Philippines, don't work. Won't work here. Again, economics and personal incomes, coordination. I heard a speaker refer to coordination, service integration, and integrity. I guess I said it strongly. Maybe it won't work. I can't imagine how it works, but I should say.
What about smaller buses?
Smaller buses. Yeah. 70% of the, roughly 70% of the cost of operation of a bus is a driver. 20-foot bus or 100-foot bus is going to cost a driver. The capital costs are a bit less. The operating costs for fuel consumption, which is obviously a factor, as I recall, typically in the transit industry, fuel consumption makes about 15% of the operating budget. If you reduce that 15% by some, you do have an improvement, right. But in the rush hours, you need full buses. And this city is, without exception, the best in Canada and amongst the best in North America for ridership levels in a city its size. That's one of the reasons I chose to come to work.
You know, it's a temptation to engage you in a conversation because you know your stuff and we're all very interested in what you have to say. I guess I have to come back to what my job is, which is to have you continue with the solutions and then we'll have to wrap up after one or two more speakers. Thanks. No, go ahead.
Okay. Fuel prices are an issue, obviously, affecting car use. Look at Canada versus Europe and Japan. Again, wide disparity in pricing fuel. That affects the choice of use of the car.
And what would you do to solve that problem? In other words, we're talking here
public,
about
on the
solutions.
News media? Yeah. Well, you know, obviously, a solution is to, in some manner or another, increase the price of fuel.
Right.
I'm not so sure I recommend that, but that's a solution.
Yeah, sure.
Integration of modes is essential. Full integration of all modes is absolutely essential, including being able to bike, for example, to bike from your home to the nearest bus stop, I don't know how to do it yet, mind you, but I'm going to keep on this discussion.
Right.
Put that bike on a bus or lock it up at the bus stop, one of the two. Continue your trip and if at the other end, get your bike off the bus or maybe finish it on foot or something. Somehow better integration. I don't have any solutions on that. I spent some time in San Diego last fall doing that and some other things and some other cities, seeing how they carry bikes on buses. Hamilton's working on that project right now. I think Kitchener might be. I'm not sure.
Right.
Don't know how they're doing it, but we're watching those kind of things.
Great.
We can't be left out when the time comes. Singapore is a city, I think it's Singapore, no cars in CBD, Central Business District. There's a gate up there, basically, and huge fees or fines. I'm not sure how it works, but no cars. Somebody talked about rail. If you're familiar with the rail operations, and particularly the collective agreements that bind and determine how rail work is to be done, they're archaic. They're centuries old in some conditions. And please correct me where I make a mistake here, but I don't think a rail train driver, engineer, whatever, can drive more than, I think, 60 miles a day. Is that still correct? Or something?
Rail companies had 47 collective agreements at one point in time. They are coming down because the rail industry is shrinking as it has been. But now in the States, for instance, you're running with a two-man crew, and the engineer is not only the engineer, he's the track maintenance person, he does the sales as well. So that's the change.
The Canadian rail industry, the collective agreements are very restrictive. In addition to the track rates away and all those kind of issues, the operating costs are, I consider them outrageous because of collective agreement restrictions.
Solution?
On the rail side of it? Everybody, all partners involved there have to come to the 21st century on that issue.
Okay.
I got lots more, but that's enough.
Thank you very much. No, your comments are very good ones. We have time for one more person, and I'm going to ask that gentleman in the back, if you don't mind, only because he hasn't spoken yet. Thank you very much.
It's funny, he just tapped on something I was going to say about negotiations with rails and unions and governments. The two points I wanted to make was to reiterate the one that was made over here, that I've worked with the government. I know that a lot of people talk about writing letters, a lot of people talk about making phone calls, a lot of people talk about lobbying. They don't do it. You ask your friends, you ask your mom, your dad, whatever. The amount of democratic participation is very low still. And when you're in a minister's office and you walk in the morning and you see the fax machine filled with lobbyists from the transportation associations, from the amalgamated Teamsters, from all the groups, the lobby groups, they do their work. But the individuals, they're intimidated. They're intimidated by big government. You have to continually hammer at your politicians. That is the only gauge by which, if they want to do the job, they can hold those letters up and hold those phone calls up and say, look at the people want it. When I lobbied to try to get commuter lanes in the 401, I was told the ratio of who, the forces of evil that I was fighting and, the few people that were advocating for commuter lanes. They were not going to do it. And now in new highway production, new highway development 407, there is going to be a trial commuter lane, and in the city there is going to be some. Anyway, I'm just saying you got to push, and this is a wonderful example of democracy. Part two, though, is sort of the bit about what Mark was saying and a couple other people, is that you have to do the carrot and stick. You cannot go to someone and expect them to support you if you don't give them a way out, i.e. you can't go to the unions and say, well, we want to, get into the 90s, we got to totally change your structure in terms of operations of railroads. You have to offer them retraining, you have to offer them retirement packages, we have to do that. And that's the struggle going on in the social contract right now with the Ray government, and we have to look at the big picture. You can't just say, well, I know the solution, and therefore you have to lose, we'll win. And that's unfortunately what a lot of environmentalists are facing. So those are the two points I wanted to make. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I'm afraid that's going to have to conclude the proceedings for this evening. What we're going to wrap up with right now is some comments from Cheryl Anderson Langmuir, another member of the roundtable and an organizer of this particular process. She's going to summarize tonight and tell us how we can be involved from here on in the other sessions on energy, land use, and solid waste. Cheryl?
Thanks, Tony. Before I wrap up and tell you what else you can get involved in, I'd just like to thank the radio technicians. Just in case we run out of time, I want to thank Kent Wakely, Magali Meager, and especially Nick Taylor, who went through and read our whole challenge paper at the beginning of this program. I also would like to just tell you about the rest of the meetings that we've got coming up. On May 19th at Westwood United Church, we've got land use and development. On May 27th at Willow Road School, we've got energy. On June 2nd at Ottawa Crescent School, we've got solid waste. And we have a wrap-up general all-issues meeting coming up on June 8th at Central School. All those meetings run from 7 till 9 o'clock at night. I hope that everyone here will come out at least to one other meeting and participate in the process. In addition, I'd also just like to tell you that we've got neighborhood meetings going on all summer. We've got 8 different neighborhoods identified, and you'll probably be hearing about those in your own neighborhood. We have challenge papers over on the table, and they have been distributed throughout the city. Hopefully anyone who hasn't seen a challenge paper will take one home tonight, answer some questions, write to us and tell us your concerns, tell us what issues are important to you and what solutions you see to those issues. I'd also like to give you our telephone number, 763-3814. You can phone and leave us a message, and we'll be happy to get back to you or hear anything that you have to say on that number, and I'd like to thank you all for coming tonight.